This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barry's, a podcast from Guardian Australia. Well, Budget Tuesday week, and we already know one initiative that won't be in it. There will be no increases to the taxes on gas exports. The government's position seems to be, if you weren't so naive, you wouldn't have called for it in the first place. And I'll explain what I mean by that a little later on. And something else that won't be in the budget, not this one anyway, is Angus Taylor's idea for increasing fuel reserves and bringing back refineries, which will mean an extra cent per litre to pay for it. And beyond that, Gina Rinehart has gifted Pauline Hanson a plane and a couple of her associates threw in $500,000 each for good measure, all on the eve of the federal by-election in Farrah, now a week away. And I've just come back from Charles Sturt University in Albury, where I hosted a debate with 9 of the 12 candidates. And Tony, I want to set it up with a couple of highlights. The first I raised about the Liberal Party and the National Party's controversial decision to preference One Nation ahead of the strong independent candidate, Michelle Millthorpe. The Liberal candidate is Reza Bukowski. There's a couple of references here to Brad. Brad is Brad Robertson, the National Party candidate.
We're in a coalition. Obviously, Brad is our number two. In terms of preferencing, it really was it was just the ease of reference in terms of our how to vote card, and that's just the reality.
Why do you prefer David Farley over Michelle Millthorpe?
It's no question of preferring anybody. At the end of the day, people are going to preference who they want to preference. And that's just the reality.
Then you could have an open ticket. Why did you choose to direct preferences?
Ultimately, at the end of the day, I like Michelle. I think we get on really well.
So, Tony, we had a situation there where that is an issue that you'd think they'd be facing up to every day. It sounded to me like she'd never been asked the question before, or if she had, she was not prepared for it.
No, she wasn't very confident on that. Didn't sound particularly polished. But it is a really tricky question for the Liberal Party, and I suspect they did go through a few notes with her on that inevitable question. But there's no perfect solutions for the Liberal Party on this. There's only imperfect choices. And the downside is that if One Nation get elected, they're legitimising the party. They're making them, you know, a more credible second option, second choice for voters over themselves. Because remember, the national polls, the coalition are in the low 20s and One Nation are north of 25. So their first strategic objective is to get over the top of One Nation. But then when you're preferencing them and putting them, giving them an effective beachhead into the House of Reps with Barnaby, who's already there, albeit elected under the National Party banner, that's making them more credible, and it's a permission structure for other voters to say, oh, well, you know, there's two members now and I can vote again. However, by effectively putting in a Teal candidate who's more closely aligned to Labor, then they're also creating problems for themselves. So there's no perfect solutions.
Yeah, and just before I move on to the second highlight that I want to play, Peter, an email. Angus Taylor recently said preferencing One Nation is aimed at preventing a stronger Teal political preference. However, he says, David says, that the Teals, to him, represent the values of centre-right urban voters. They are socially progressive while being physically conservative. And he writes, there are many voters who will find it hard to support the Liberals because preferencing One Nation indicates a shift further away from the sensible centre, as he calls it, to the more flaky far right. That's the danger. That's the kind of message that they're sending out there. I should also make the point that she does not represent herself as Teal. Mm. It's been used as an insult against her.
But she does get funding from Climate 200.
She got 2% or something, yep, of her funding from Climate 200, but she doesn't even support net zero.
Yep.
She's not a Teal. She's not in line with the thinking of most of the Teals that we now recognise. And that's because Farrah is very different to Indi. Like, Indi is classic independent country. A lot of new people come in, and you get towns like Yarkandandah and Beechworth and all the way up the highway to those outer suburbs of Melbourne, whereas Farrah is old school.
Yeah.
And it hasn't changed, hasn't been transformed in the way that, that Indi has. And she's quite adamant about that. She's not a tool. But the, I think the point that Peter makes is a good one, that it goes to the attitudes that people are interpreting coming out of the Liberal Party.
Back to my theme about imperfect options here. I think for the Liberal Party, you know, their strategic objective is to get to number two, get over the top of One Nation, not in Farah, but in the national polls, because you can't beat Labor from third spot. Once they get to number two, then I think their strategic objective is, can they possibly, and there's no guarantee here at all, can they possibly put together a coalition of supporters to get to 51% again? Now, that's got to be incredibly difficult, and it may never happen, but they can't win from third.
Yeah. Then I went on to ask David Farley, the One Nation candidate, about a couple of things that were revealed during the week. And one was that he actually flirted with Labor about running for them 3 or 4 years ago. And then just a year ago at the last election, when Michelle Millthorpe went reasonably close to beating Susan Lee, he put out a post at the time on Facebook, and he said that Michelle Millthorpe was a straight shooter and a good woman. And he compared during this answer that finding your political allegiances. He's 69, right? He's not a 20-year-old still trying to find his way. He compared that with working out in a gym where you just sort of try all the equipment. Here it is.
Senator Jane Hume put out a statement today, and the headline was, "Who is David Farley?" And Senator Hume says, 4 years ago, you wanted to be a Labor candidate. 1 year ago, at the last general election, you were endorsing the teal candidate. That's the, Jane Hume's term. And the same candidates that you're now running against. And in between, you've made donations to both Labor and the Teals. What do you say to that?
Well, I say to Jane Hume, it's 2026. Democracy doesn't live in a museum. It actually lives in a gymnasium. It's active. It's the environment that we live in is changing, and therefore where you place your energies of public service needs to be matched and aligned.
If that's the case, you'd be pretty fit because you've just... Yeah. 3 years ago, the Labor Party... Well, 1 year ago, you were endorsing Michelle.
Well, yes. Well, first of all, yes, I am pretty fit, so thank you.
Well, that was his way of dealing with that. But it was. Does that represent a new tactic on the part of the Liberal Party? Are they starting now at this very late hour to go in a bit harder on One Nation and make them more accountable?
Yeah, well, they have to. They have to drive down their primary vote. According to polling reports in the media, the coalition's primary is sort of barely over 20. So, you know, if they can possibly potentially get it up to 30 over the next week or so, that'll make him more competitive. It's going to be very difficult for them to win. He does sound very polished, doesn't he? How did he come across with the audience? Was he engaging them?
Yes, but the audience was the independent did very well in terms of getting the numbers along, and they were all wearing their orange T-shirts. So it kind of gave a false impression of where the support rested. But he handled himself very well. Look, he's not your typical, he doesn't present as your typical One Nation figure. But I tell you what really struck me, not just during the debate, but spending some time up there and talking to so many people about the situation is, look, we all talk about the phenomena that has been One Nation over the last year and the continuing kind of presence of independents as competitive candidates. But the thing is, in such a short time, the Liberal Party won this seat a year ago. They're not even part of the conversation when you're talking to people anymore. They're not part of the conversation. The Nationals are not part of the conversation. It's almost as if the organisation has just, you know, disappeared. It's I've got to say it's kind of slightly eerie when you're in a rural and regional place like the electorate of Farah, and they're just not. They're certainly not in this contest. And if that's the case, there are a lot of seats like Farah. I made a distinction with Indi before, but you go further north in New South Wales and certainly in Queensland, the Liberal and National parties are going to have contests in these kind of seats.
Yeah. I think with 21% of One Nation voters in our polling saying that they're voting for One Nation because they can't stand their major parties, they're sick and tired of them, you're going to find that in a lot of these electorates, particularly where they feel that they're not getting the outcomes, you know, health, hospital care, aged care, childcare, and roads. And so I think there's a lot of grievance in these areas, and they have been underfunded, I think, by a lot of governments in recent times. So I can see the rise of One Nation becoming particularly problematic, and I'd be looking closely at Victoria election later this year in the Victorian regions.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that what struck me is that how seamlessly they seem to have accepted in a sort of a matter-of-fact way that the Liberals and the Nationals are not in this contest. And I think because in the mindset of a lot of them and those who will support One Nation, they just want to give them all a kick in the bum. That's basically what it's about. Just before we move on from this, I want to mention the Phantom of Farrah. There's a guy called Roger Woodward who's on he's one of the 12 candidates. There hasn't been a single sighting that I could find from talking to people in the electorate since the campaign began. The Border Mail, the ABC up there, tell me that they've constantly tried to get into contact with this Roger Woodward. So if anybody has a sighting anywhere in the electorate from Wentworth to Albury, please email backtobackbarrys@theguardian.com. I'd be interested to know what he's up to. But I did check him out. He also stood in the seat of Barara at the federal election. So that's the kind of Hornsby Shire, Hawkesbury River area. And
it's a little bit north of Farrah.
A little bit north of Farrah. And I am told that he was once sighted at Wiseman's Ferry. If anybody's looking for him, that might be a starting point. But it was, he's... it's a strange phenomenon in the electorate. Angus Taylor's refinery plan now, and you know why he's doing it. Just for starters, the International Energy Agency, of which Australia is a member, has a technical requirement that that all of their countries hold stocks equal to 90 days, and we're about 30 days. He wants to get up to 60. What do you make of that? Do you think it can fly?
Yeah, I think the longer term, the self-sufficiency argument in Australia will hold. It's already starting to, ever since COVID, when there was disruptions to supply chains, particularly on medical supplies. Andrew Hastie tapped into that in 2019. He called for the 90-day fuel reserve in response to Bill Shorten making it part of his campaign pitch in 2019. ScoMo decided not to match that 90-day policy, because it would have cost around $15-20 billion, and I think they decided to put it all into sports announcements. It's one of those unfortunate things. It would have been obviously wouldn't have been a solution to the problem we're in right now, but a 90-day reserve is a hell of a lot better than a 30-day reserve.
Yeah, and it's not a pessimistic approach. It's probably a realistic one. It's based on the possibility or even probability that there'll be more situations like the Iran war.
But I'm not sure about announcing a levy on petrol to pay for it.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
When you're trying to position yourself as the lower tax party, which is clearly where they're going after their unsuccessful bid last time where they became the higher taxing party, that creates a bit of a problem for them, I think. And, they've got to get their narrative straight, because at the moment the Liberal Party doesn't have an identity. And, of course, there are a few interesting policy announcements coming up in the budget. There's a lot of kite flying going on about potential new taxes. Yeah. So where the Liberal Party lands on that, it might even contradict this new sort of levy on petrol.
Yeah, and the problem is that the last election they disastrously opposed a cut in income taxes, and now they're actually introducing what is effectively a new tax. You really don't have to deal with that one. We'll get to what we think will be in the budget in a moment, but what we now know won't be in the budget. There will be no increase on gas exports. Now, Anthony Albanese says that in the current climate, you don't want to upset these international oil companies, Japan, Korea, because that would have an impact on the reliability of our fuel. So that's kind of the geo-eco explanation around it. But what it means is you forego 20, 30 billion. I don't know. There's a lot of money involved in this. And the key to it is it's one of those taxes you can raise without a single Australian being impacted. They don't pay a cent, and you can get in all this money. So Anthony Albanese, though, has said this against public opinion. The Guardian Essential poll showed 57% of Australians support an increase. Only 12% are opposed, and I presume the other 31% haven't got a clue what we're talking about. But So it's popular.
Yeah, I think the challenge for Albanese is balancing those, you know, security partner relationships that goes with that. But I think something more interesting interventions over the last week was Roger Cook, the Labor Premier of WA, who's very sensitive about WA commodity prices, came out strongly against it. It's one of those things that wasn't particularly well reported. The other story that wasn't well reported, which I think feeds into the first point, is a iron ore mine opened up in the country of Guinea. And all the funding for the infrastructure, the extraction, exploration, getting it to the port, and then you know, building the port infrastructure was paid for by China. So that's a big problem for WA. China's obviously going other places for their iron ore, will drive the prices down. And that's a real warning sign, not just to WA, but the Australian economy, that China are looking for cheaper commodities. And I think that was top of mind for Roger Cook, because I know some of the advocates for the gas tax, and as I said last week, I do believe it's not fit for purpose, the resource rent tax, and needs some change. But those advocates, you know, they sort of said, well, you know, we're not going to lose any business over this. Well, we don't know that. That's an assumption. And when China's looking for cheaper product, you can rest assured they're looking at other markets as well, because there's no shortage of commodities globally.
Yeah.
The trick is getting it to port and to market.
Now, that gained a bit of strength, that argument, because, well, we're in the Iran war, and that probably shaped the thinking. And I'm just wondering whether, if it had not been for the Iran war, whether this was the time to strike on this. But I don't think we would have got that pushback. I don't think the government would have even asked these countries their opinion on this, but they did, because they happened to be there looking for more fuel supplies. So we became more conscious of it. And so if it wasn't for the Iran war, I think this would have been the time that the Iran war might have cost us another 20 or 30 billion.
I was talking to someone this week who's very much in the defence space, international affairs, works in America quite a lot. And he sort of said, well, you know, a lot of the sector that he deals with are saying, well, what does a win for Iran look like right now? And at the moment, a win is just massive economic disruptions globally.
Yeah.
And they're sort of saying, look, this could go on for years.
Mm.
Because the longer they keep it blockaded, the rest of the economy globally suffers. And I presume some of the, you know, animosity towards America and Israel will build, which is a great win for Iran. So as my friend said, he said, mate, if they sink one ship, it all locks down for years.
Mm.
And until Saudi Arabia can open up those pipelines or expand their capacity so they can avoid the straits, then, you know, we're looking at an indefinite thing. And the impact on the global market. So I think that's very much top of mind for Albanese, because, you know, nobody needs this.
Look, I appreciate his thinking on it, but the Greens and One Nation united on this. They thought it was a good idea, David Pocock. But it's just when, if you're a prime minister and you, as a strategist, I'd be interested in how you deal with this when you're the prime minister and you're telling 57% of the people are disappointed about this. What do you say? How do you go to them and explain it? Well, you do the geopolitical, economic, you know, babble. But then he goes on to say the public campaign in support of this has been dishonest. So he's kind of saying, well, you're gullible enough to swallow their crap, you know. And his position, on the other hand, is sensible. Well, everybody else is, you know, it's populist rhetoric. I just think you need to tread a bit more warily on a topic where there's so much public support, and not dismiss that public opinion, that overwhelming public opinion, as just, you know, just being naive.
I agree with Albanese. I think the campaign has been hopeless. When you start a Senate committee and your lead witness is a social media influencer, you know, you've already lost. And I think...
Hang on. That contradicts the whole concept of influencers, Tony.
Yeah, well, no one can take that credibly. You know, a guy who's got no experience in trade, law, you know, energy, resources, and so on. So they let off with that. And I think they, you know, everyone puts a bit of mayonnaise on their arguments, both sides of this debate. But, you know, sort of saying we give it away for free is actually not true. And as Albanese came out last week and he said, which was the first sign that he was going to land on this position, because instead of doing the usual, I'm not going to rule anything in and out of a budget, which you probably invented that line back in the day, he just came out and said, well, the resource rent tax will, you know, the taxation raised was $22 billion, which was a sure sign that he was contradicting that. So I think it's important, if you're going to sort of mount a case on this, that you – you know, it's not just as simple as sort of, you know, going to the Senate committee and sort of thinking you're going to sort of make it fly across the nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll go to the budget now and what might be in it. And capital gains tax, we're not so sure about. It looks like there will be something on negative gearing. But on capital gains tax, and I'll once again run the risk of being naive, but I'll have the support of Sol Eslake, who I wrote,
yep.
And he wrote this in the Guardian during the week. And just background, and he provided this, so the Howard government introduced it 27 years ago. 50% discount on the tax that you pay on your capital gains when you sell. And it was said at the time that it would turn Australians into a nation of shareholders. He says, he argues, no, it didn't. It just boosted investment in property, mainly housing, and we became a nation of speculators. And those who reported to the tax department that they had rental property income increased from 14% before the decision to 18% now. It's not a bad argument. Will they move on capital gains and should they?
I've long advocated a reform project that looks at property and wealth. You know, I gave a speech about 5 years ago saying the Liberal Party's in danger of being the party of the landlord and Labor will be the party of renters, which is a bigger cohort. But when you're looking at the reform of taxes like negative gearing and capital gains tax and other new taxes that might come in, it's got to be offset with income tax cuts. And, you know, Phil Currie wrote a really interesting piece, his end of week column, where, you know, he effectively said, just announcing new taxes is not reform. That's just announcing new taxes. The trick is to actually reform the taxation system, which means, you know, can we cut income taxes? Because if you're going to give younger people a stake in the economy and the chance to accumulate wealth and buy a house, they need to keep more of their income.
That is part of the story, but the other part of the story is gaining revenue that's there for the taking. And when this started, when the capital gains tax was introduced, the revenue was $860 million in 2000. It's $21.8 billion now foregone.
Yep.
$21.8 billion. So it's big. It's revenue raising, and that's an important part of it. The other argument that goes against it is that this increased investment activity actually increases the supply of rental housing, and that's good because more supply, cheaper rents. Well, no, against this, oh, no. The problem is that 80% of these investments goes on established houses. 80%. So when you buy an established, when you're buying this established house, when you're an investor, you're squeezing out somebody else, a first home buyer, usually you're squeezing them out. So they remain renters. So it's a zero-sum game, you know. Yeah. So that argument doesn't hold up.
No, but, you just have to give younger people more of their income. You know, you can't just hope that, you know, increasing taxes on other sections of the market is going to suddenly make housing more affordable. The one thing that Sol Eslake column didn't mention, which nobody really mentions, is none of these economists will put a figure on how much they think it will reduce the price of housing, because they know they can't predict that.
If you've got a rental property, an investment property, and suddenly negative gearing disappears, that's going to have an impact, and it might not any longer be a viable proposition. You'll sell, and so will a lot of other people, and more people will sell, the cheaper the houses.
Yeah, but if you don't have $100,000, $150,000 deposit, then you can't buy it anyway. But and I'm not defending these taxes. I want to make that clear. But no one will put a figure to what it's going to actually reduce, and no one is suggesting it's going to be. I mean, the average house in Melbourne and Brisbane is just over $1 million, about $1,050,000 is the average. Yeah, no one is suggesting there's something going to become 800 or 700,000. In fact, most people, when you really push them, those people who are advocating, when you really push them and say, how much is this going to reduce housing? They're like, oh, a few percent actually. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not a reason not to do it. That's not a reason not to do it. But by selling it that way, you're going to upset a lot of voters when these changes are brought in. And it actually doesn't really change the house prices all that much. Mm.
The people I have sympathy for are those who are paying mortgages in the property they own. They only own a single, one house, and they live in it.
Yep.
And they don't get the benefit of negative gearing. And they got hit again this week, of course, they will next week, yep. I should say. But when inflation went up this week, then it was virtually factored in there'll be another increase. And Greg Jericho, again in The Guardian, wrote about this week. And it's almost all as a result of the impact of the Iran war and on the cost of petrol. Worse to come, of course, as that starts to flow through the economy. But he said, how would an increase in interest rates have an impact on the price of petrol? If the problem is the price of petrol, How does an interest rate rise? Why are mortgage holders being punished? It's an interesting question. It might again go into that category of me being naive, along with Greg Jericho and Sol Eastlake and One Nation and the Greens and everybody else. But interesting question.
Well, the market is predicting potentially two more interest rate rises this year. There's a lot more pain to come.
Well, that'll teach mortgage holders for the increase in the price of petrol, won't it?
Well, the real danger here is, you know, the GFC, the banks undertook that they wouldn't foreclose homes that had negative equity or people couldn't, because it was a liquidity problem at the end of the day. And it was a big problem, but it was liquidity. They're not going to offer that this time. So if you've got negative equity in your property and the housing market starts falling, or you have to reverse mortgage, or you've only got, say, 10, 15% equity in your house, the banks will foreclose, and that's going to be real pain that we haven't seen for you know, a few generations.
Yeah, well, that's all pretty creepy, Tony. We have been there before, of course, with the recession in the late 80s.
Yeah, I might have given you PTSD because you were there in the middle of it as Hawke's press sec. When you look back at that period, Hawke and Keating were incredibly brave. In 1987, the stock market crash, which was a precursor to the recession that was sort of felt globally, especially in Australia. You know, Hawke wrote to Ronald Reagan asking him to reduce the budget deficit in the United States. Yeah, can you imagine doing that to Trump now? Holy moly. Hawke asked the Conciliation Arbitration Commission to defer the national wage case. He cut company tax from 49 to 39. And then when the recession started biting, he actually flattened the tax base more. He introduced the CGT. He introduced fringe benefits tax, but then he started cutting income tax because when he inherited the economy from Fraser, income tax was at 60%, which is terrifying, and he started cutting it down to 50, sub 50, because he recognised that, you know, we had to flatten the tax base. He also called for cutting the tariffs, which I'm really interested in your recollections of that, because he cut it down to 5%, which was incredibly brave to do in that sort of economic environment. I mean, now any prime minister who ran that up the flagpole would kill it within an hour. They'd be running around, you know, the press gallery, sort of running into, you know, David Spears' office and Phil Currie and sort of, you know, hitting the kill button.
Yeah, so you've got two different constituencies there, and both of them are going to be alarmed by that. First of all, the companies that enjoy the protection that they come with tariffs, so we're dealing with that. Plus, here is a former ACTU advocate who would go in there regularly and argue for wage rises, and he's saying, I want them to stall wages.
Yeah.
So it was a contradiction of everything that he kind of represented up until then. But again, it just demonstrates that when the crisis is felt, you know, when it's really evident to everybody, then that is the time that you can take action if you go out and explain it properly. And I think that's what happened at the time.
I mean, you're in the middle of all this. I mean, as a press sec, sort of selling these tough changes. Yeah, how'd you go about that?
Left it to Paul Keating.
Yeah. Good strategy.
he was good at it.
I wonder if Jim Chalmers, you know, who's a student of Paul Keating, did his doctorate on him.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's looking at that template, because at the moment he's talking about raising a few new taxes. I wonder if he's looking at some of these really tough decisions and reforms that Keating had to do and sort of looking at that and sort of think, well, how can we replicate that?
Yeah, I think there'll be elements of that there, and he does talk to Keating a lot.
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, I want to raise you some immigration figures that came out this week that are really, truly historic.